Conciliums
with Pete and Charlie.
I'm Pete.
I'm Charlie.
The unity of knowledge.
That and a whole bunch of caffeine is what's going to get us through this.
Ask me if we're recording.
Are we recording?
Yes. What is wrong with you?
What is the topic of the podcast today, Charlie?
Of
Conciliance.
With?
Pete and Charlie.
I'm Charlie.
And I'm Pete.
That's it.
Doesn't one of us get to say the unity of knowledge? I feel like I'm, what's his name? The physicist. Who's the physicist?
Carl Sagan?
No, the guy that's still
Neil
alive.
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Neil deGrasse Tyson. The unity of knowledge. To boldly go where two bald men have never gone bald. Never gone balding before. That's not me, ladies and gentlemen. That's all the cough syrup talking.
Page 219. From the chapter, The Arts and Their Interpretation. We begin with objects that look dissimilar. We compare, find patterns, analogies with what we already know. We distance ourselves and create abstractions, laws, systems, using transformations, mappings, and metaphors. This is how mathematics grows increasingly abstract and powerful. It is how music obtains much of its power, with grand structures growing out of small details. This form of comprehension underlies much of the Western thought. We pursue knowledge that is universal in its perspective, but its powers are grounded in the particular. We use principles that are shared, but reveal details that are distinct. That's from Hideki Yukawa, who E.O. Wilson says, spent his career working on the nuclear binding forces of the atom, making discoveries for which he became the first Japanese to receive the Nobel Prize in Physics.
And that was from Consilience by E.O. Wilson.
That excerpt, E.O. Wilson found that he curated that particular quote in his...
Is that what you call it? When you if it's a joke in a comedian, it's called stealing. But here it's called curated?
Actually, I might be making a joke myself.
Okay.
I might be stealing a joke. So that paragraph actually came to mind after I watched you stand up in front of a bunch of... freshman
you mean
and sophomore,
with my collaborator, with Lou Lefton, from the School of Mathematics?
And you all ran a small version of your idea workshop.
Yeah, actually, it was that was pretty elongated because we did all the sort of theory on Tuesday when I was out of town.
You mean that Lou did the theory? You left him high and dry.
Yeah, I'm better with the theory. I probably do that better. And then Lou does the improv better, so I stuck him with my part and then helped him with his part. So,
but Lou's carrying you. Is that what you're
saying?
He's
carrying me. Most people do carry me. But yeah, idea workshop.
Speaking of carrying you, just go ahead and keep talking. don't freak out. What's about to happen?
Are you going to adjust my microphone again?
I am going to adjust your microphone.
I don't like it when you touch things near me.
Don't freak out. Okay. Keep talking.
So Charlie mentioned IDEA Workshop. That's an acronym for Improvisational Design of Engineering Alternatives. And as I recall, when Nobel laureate Harry Curto was on my weekly radio program, Inside the Black Box, he said, Pete, to get the Nobel Prize, you not only need to come up with an amazing and broad impacting idea, you also have to give it a cool name. And supposedly, he was the guy that called Buckyballs Buckminster Fullerene, as opposed to C60, spherical carbon.
Whoa, you just said Buckyballs?
Buckyballs.
What is Buckyballs?
Buckyballs is just the vernacular for Buckminster Fullerene. It is a...
You can't get away with that. First off, what? Second off,
He said buckyballs. That sounds dirty.
So Buckminster Fullerene, which I know we've talked on the show before, talked about on the show before. Why is it called buckyballs?
Because very likely Harry Curto and other people maybe.
Are you going to apologize to everyone for drinking Mountain Dew directly into their ears?
I'm drinking Mellow Yellow.
Sorry, same color.
I have a cold, or I'm getting over a cold, so I'm spewing germs all over this urethane foam microphone cover.
I'm going to spray myself down with a...
I have a feeling you spray yourself down on a regular basis and has nothing to do with my cold. no, so I'm just trying to keep my voice. And
lubricate your throat with high fructose corn syrup.
C60, this soccer ball-shaped thing of carbon, this big molecule.
Right,
it's got 60 carbon atoms. And it is something that we thought was very rare, but in fact, little bits of it come out just from burning, just in your soot. There's probably little bits of it and other interesting forms of carbon in the form of tubes and other size balls. And it looks like a geodesic dome. It has the geometric pattern of a geodesic dome, which was invented by Buckminster Fullerene as an architectural form.
Buckminster Fuller.
sorry, Buckminster Fuller, right.
Right.
A really neat guy who designed interesting houses and cars and interesting functional shapes. He was a cool dude. So to call it Buckminster Fullerene kind of makes sense. That's the name of the molecule. So yeah, that's why we have idea. Get it? Idea? our slogan is we put the ha in aha. And people don't like that as much. It's not as elegant as Buckminster
Fullerene. You know, whenever you get into the details of anything, so it's a little disappointing.
Yeah, so Bucky Balls is not the testicles of your neighbor named Bucky. It's
but it's called Bucky Balls because the thing looks like a ball.
Yeah, and there are a few. There's a C60 and there are less stable ones like C70 and things like that. So
I am here on the dreaded Wikipedia.
You hate the Wikipedia.
I know, but Google, this is the first thing it brings up. So I'm looking at, it looks like a child's jungle gym.
Yeah.
You know, something in the that metal hexagonal set of hexagonal shapes.
Yeah, hexagons and pentagons.
Yeah. Oh, pentagons and hexagons. That's super cool.
It's a veritable cornucopia of geometric shapes.
Now, cornucopias are an actual thing. Don't start mixing up actual things. They take a ram's horn, they fill it with food and fruit, man, and corn.
Isn't a cornucopia a real thing?
It's a real thing.
Buckminster Fullerene's a real thing.
I'm just saying, you don't call the
am
real
I mixing
thing
my
some
metaphors?
Other...
Is that what I'm...
Really, I just want to argue with you about
no, but
horns
speaking of geometric
corn
shapes, have you ever noticed geometric shapes are always associated with warlike things? And I was in Washington, D.C. over the weekend.
You talking about balls now? What's going on?
No, I was telling jokes to some folks from the Emerging Frontiers and Research and Innovation portion of the National Science Foundation. And I actually got to tell jokes in front of scientists, and it was really cool. They stopped me at the end and said, can we ask questions? Oh, that was exciting. the director of the program asked me that. And we talked all about...
No, wait, go back to that. So tell me why that was exciting.
Well, because normally when
you
do...
What thought was going to happen and what did happen.
30 to 90 minutes of funny jokes about science and technology, it's more like a show. Even though it is educational, it's more like a show. People don't normally ask you questions. But the director of the Emerging Frontiers and Research and Innovation program said, can we ask questions? And she asked me a question about the Big Bang Theory. And I had interviewed the physics consultant for that. My radio program, so we talked about that and all sorts of things, and I picked up some interesting...
Did that dude apologize for Big Bang Theory being base and uninteresting?
No, those people love the Big Bang Theory, and I think that Big Bang Theory may be a way to reach people without advanced degrees
in
science and engineering, or normal people, as we like to call them.
That's your trademark phrase.
That is my trademark
phrase. I don't like the Big Bang Theory. I know that we've already talked about this, but
I know we have.
I don't think it's funny.
There's not much that you do like. You're just bitter and angry.
I am. If you look at my picture, you will see.
But in any case, this improvisational workshop, in a nutshell, right? And I hate people that obfuscate. And we had a guy from Syracuse University on my radio program once who did not obfuscate on the radio, but he did in his paper, and he admitted that.
This is your big words episode, isn't it? You always get on me about the big words, but this is your turn to use the
yeah,
complicated
obfuscate,
Latinate
I
words.
Like to. What is the vernacular for obfuscate? To confuse?
Fuck up.
No, that phrase means a lot of additional things that I do on a regular basis as well.
I like getting a bleep in there every once in a while.
It was a really neat guy who loves humor and writes on humor, and he uses humor in his classroom. I think he's totally cool. But he wrote this paper that characterized the humor of Eddie Izzard. And I pronounce it Izzard because I believe that is the correct pronunciation. He's a comedian.
Not the
British
correct
comedian. He's a little
correct, but yeah.
He's a little cross-dressy. He wears eyeshadow, likes to dress like a woman.
I think a little less transvestitism these days, but yeah.
Yeah, and I don't really care. I think he's a funny
guy.
He's
hilarious.
He's hilarious. Yeah.
I love him. That's something I like.
Yeah. No, so do I. I think he's hilarious.
Pete.
And this guy wrote a paper for, I think, an anthropology journal explaining the humor of Eddie Izzard. And when he explained that on the show, he said what makes him funny is he takes a historical event from a different time and puts it in a different time than when it occurred, like modern times.
Yeah.
And it's that change in context that makes it funny.
The anachronism.
It's easy to understand.
Of,
yes, an anachronism, yeah. Essentially. It's easy to understand why that works. If you watch him do it, he does it beautifully. The first example of this I can think of historically was Bob Newhart. Bob Newhart did a thing as the publicist or the press agent for Abraham Lincoln. And he's on the phone with Abraham Lincoln going, Abe, no. Keep the 77 years ago. It tested well in focus groups, that kind of thing. And he had this whole conversation.
And just to add on to that, have you seen the Gettysburg Address as a PowerPoint presentation?
No, that sounds funny.
Yes, well, and someone did it to basically mess with PowerPoint to show how Lincoln's speech might have been disrupted and just obfuscated by PowerPoint.
Really crappy too. Maybe.
Yeah. I mean, somewhere 77 years ago, our forefathers. Yes, next slide, please. You know that kind of added that horrible knowing. That does not help the presentation. That right. sort of the meta presentation is bad when the person's saying, "Oh yeah, next slide," and I'm just going to read this to you and that sort of thing.
Do you hate PowerPoint?
No. Yeah, I do.
I think PowerPoint's a fabulously effective tool when it's used correctly. When it's used correctly, it's great. But so many people use it so poorly.
You got me on a day where I'm happy to say that I hate everything. But
okay, fair enough.
But I like a lot of things too, and. This is nice. The microphones are bringing me back down to the sort of the truth-telling spot. I think that PowerPoint is an incredibly powerful slideshow manager. Yeah. And I think that those templates are probably the worst thing that PowerPoint brings because people pour a presentation into those templates.
Yeah.
They don't think about what they're trying to get across.
Yeah. And they overuse things like bullets.
Yeah, bullet points. And I have seen many presentations where the person's head is turned back towards the screen. And they're reading their slides.
Yeah.
And you know that that's death. That is the death of communication.
Yeah, I watched a number of presentations at this American Society of Engineering Education meeting, some of which were very good, and some of which were literally just 20 solid minutes of bullets.
Yeah.
And you just wanted to take your life by your own hand.
And it doesn't have to be PowerPoint. That's the thing.
Yeah, it could be 35 millimeter slides. It could be whatever
right.
you have.
It could be your notes. It's just PowerPoint makes it so easy. And easy because it is very hard to do presentations. And so the fact that you can say, here's my template picture words, title, bullet points. You know,
you can whip up a horrible presentation in 10 minutes now.
Yeah, and if you're terrified having that backup, there's a template and this is how you're supposed to do it to ease the pain of putting the presentation together. It's, it's like crack for public speaking fear. It would be like crack for, this metaphor is terrible, but it's like very strong drugs for a person who needs very strong drugs.
Crystal meth, ladies and gentlemen, because... No, just kidding.
So PowerPoint has done bad things, much like guns.
But it's done some good things.
But the tool is not the problem.
The tool is not bad. It's the way people use the tool.
Yeah. And also the narrative surrounding the tool. Ooh,
back to the
found narrative. Something to talk about. Yeah, the story around PowerPoint, that you can use PowerPoint to create your presentation, as opposed to you can use PowerPoint to manage the slides for your presentation that you should have created before you came to PowerPoint.
Right.
But that's really hard, and I've done it too. I've poured a presentation into PowerPoint and popped it up there, mostly because I knew that I would be just one of many mediocre presenters, not the mediocre presenter.
Right. So if you were given a TED Talk, you'd put more feeling into it?
If I was given a TED Talk, I would have to use those heavy drugs we're talking about. I don't think they get to use PowerPoint slides or slides. I shouldn't call them PowerPoint slides. I don't think they get to use slides in TED Talks.
I'm trying to remember. I've watched a lot of TED Talks.
I see all those videos. I've never seen someone say, next slide, please. Hold for edit.
No, I'm just trying to remember. But a good talk is a good talk, no matter what visual aid you're using.
You should...
And a bad talk is a bad talk.
You should never rely on slides for your script. That's important. So if you ever find that... And this section is where I'll turn back and read it. Then you've blown it.
Okay.
Anyway, we've gone off on a terrible tangent, and let's reel it back. Idea workshop. Someone told you that you can win a Nobel Prize if you just give it a good name.
Well, yeah, Harry Carter, who did win a Nobel Prize. That's why we have a cool acronym. Lou Lefton is our acronym guy. I don't think he came up with the idea, but he's big on acronyms. He's very good at that. And what we did today is what were those, freshmen and sophomore?
Freshmen and sophomore.
In Lou Lefton's No, in Ray Vito's
GT2803
and collaborators,
class. Yeah.
My invention class, is that what it's called?
Your idea, your invention.
Right. So Ray Vito has been instrumental in getting our students here at Georgia Tech to invent and innovate and do cool things with their ideas and turn them into products and companies. He's also heavily involved with Merrick First and Craig Forrest in the Inventure competition, which aired, was it last night or the night before?
Just last night, but this will not be for a while.
Oh, yeah. So it's already happened by the time you listen to this podcast.
And in fact, that kid's probably already blown the money.
What is it, like $15,000?
20, I think.
20? What do you mean? What, did he go to Vegas and bet it on black or something?
Yeah, he probably used it to set up his basement workshop, buy some whiteboards, a machine that keeps ping, a bunch of other stuff.
And these are really, really good things. So Lou and I have done workshops for the Inventure Prize and now for this class.
Don't forget the hookers and blow.
Is that why we do it?
No, that's what you blow your money on.
Oh. Do people really blow their money on hookers and blow anymore? I don't think so.
If you've spent all your money on hookers and blow, give us a call. Tell us what happened.
Next week on Consilience with Pete and Charlie, people that blew all their money on hookers and blow. And of course, we say that as a joke, ladies and gentlemen. We are in no way encouraging people to blow their money on hookers and blow.
Blow it on blow?
Do people even do cocaine anymore? Isn't that passé now?
I'm sure there must be someone doing cocaine somewhere.
Okay, but they're doing crack or rock or other sort of geometric name about that. I don't know.
Despite all of your jokes, I have no idea what drugs people use anymore.
I don't either.
I haven't been high in years.
If you count caffeine, it's right now, but...
Is that a high? I think technically it is not.
Yeah, this cough syrup's pretty good, I'll tell you that. Dextromethorphan.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I'm completely wrong. That's not true. I took a painkiller that was... what's the oxycodone?
Oxycodone, yeah.
What is that classified as? Do you know? Are you hip to the pharmaceuticals?
No. What do you mean, hip to the guys that sell it in the street?
You are the kind of person that if you throw a polymer into a conversation, you will deconstruct it and toss it around. And I just didn't know if you were also hip to how the pharmaceuticals
work. Well, I sometimes
work.
Take a diphenhydramine hydrochloride before I go to bed.
That's what I'm talking about.
That's so Benadryl.
What's oxycodone?
Oxycodone is oxycodone. I think that's the trade name for it. I can't give you the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemists name for it.
Well, what kind of
are you addicted to OxyContin like Rush Limbaugh?
Not even a little bit.
Okay.
No, I just took one pill.
Why?
Because my back.
Oh, your back hurts?
All the time. But it was really bad that one time. So I took it, and I was high. I was high.
Oh, yeah. I often take, what's the stuff Elvis was addicted to?
Everything.
Percodan.
Percodan or Percocet?
No, Percodan was aspirin mixed with this... really good stuff. Percocet is the new one. That's Tylenol mixed with this really good stuff. I sometimes get prescribed that when I have an injury. And if you have an injury, you know, I broke my arm recently. I broke my nose before. You know, you get a broken bone or something.
Yeah.
Or you're recovering from surgery. They'll give you some of those. And I can't take those during the day. I take them at night to sleep. And it's hard to sleep with pain, right?
Oh, really hard.
But I can't take them during the day because you're loopy. Yeah, mm-hmm. I get stoned and fall asleep when I do those. So you can't function on Percocet.
You can't function on
or oxycodone
most
or.
You can't function on these things unless you do them all the time.
And you get used to them.
And that's kind of the joy of being addicted to something is that you can take it all the time and still do what you need to do.
I can't even hold my liquor. You know, I have two drinks. I'm ready to take a nap.
When's the last time you did some day drinking?
What is this day drinking of which you speak?
Drinking during the day.
Give me a time. I mean, I was out at this American Society of Engineering Education meeting, and we had a lovely reception at a local winery. And I had a few glasses of a very nice Cabernet Sauvignon.
And what time was that?
6 o'clock.
In the evening.
Yeah, that was the pre-dinner tasting. I bought two bottles of their wine.
That is not day drinking. Day drinking.
Okay. Day drinking is like 9 o'clock in the morning. Yay,
let me set you up for this. So Budweiser is a good breakfast beer.
As opposed to Dos Equis, you should wait for lunch.
So you did this idea workshop.
Okay. And so
in front of the GT2803 kids who are doing an innovation class.
Obfuscate, as my colleague from Syracuse once said, he he described this Eddie Izzard humor as changing the time frame of something. But in the paper, he called it a chronotope. He invented a word, chrono meaning time, tope meaning, I don't know what that means.
How did you feel about that, reading an article that was basically dissecting humor?
I read a lot of the articles out of Humor, the International Journal of Humor Research, published in Germany, and I don't understand a word
of it. It's German?
It's German. The people that brought you Lederhosen run the only humor research journal in the world. One of the starters, though, is actually, he's an American. I'm trying to think, what college did he come from? I was just reading about him the other day. Oh, actually, no. Was it UGA? I think it's UGA. Someone here in Georgia.
Well, now I have to look it up. Okay, you keep talking. I'm going to look it up.
Okay. But in any case, and he's no longer with the journal, so you wouldn't find it on Humor, the International Journal of Human Research. So, yeah, I think a lot of the writing is difficult. I think we need very practical yet longitudinal studies to figure out the effect of humor on various things like engineering education. but what we're doing is, if you are trapped somewhere, you may be trapped somewhere in energy space. You need some energy to get over the barriers that keep you trapped there. So if you are, you know, a molecule or a piece of material and you have certain properties and you want to change those properties, you add energy, energy to get you out of that trapped state. And then the material gets softer and it anneals, it changes its properties because the molecules change their shape and arrangement. And that energy is temperature. Temperature gets you out of that. Same thing in idea space. You and I are sitting here, we're brainstorming. We're thinking about a way to come up with a new, give me a suggestion of something new we want to build or design. A new beard trimmer, because we have beards.
Nice.
Something like the Flowbee, I'm thinking, you know, with the vacuum cleaner. That's actually a really good design. I love that. but in any case, we think of, you know, the way beard trimmers are always things, you know, blades and this and that. Maybe we should do a circular cutter like a weed whacker or something like that.
Well, Flowbee, I like that, actually. Something that makes the beard, the length of the beard, like pulls the hair out.
Because that's what a hairstylist does. They grab it with their fingers or their comb.
Yeah.
But in any case, if you want to get something truly
maybe
unique.
Maybe something that would just untangle. Something that would stop this from being so itchy.
Oh, sorry, dude. You're touching yourself in an impure manner now.
I haven't shaved in so long.
but in any case, so the energy to get you out of this local minimum, this rut in idea space, has to come from somewhere. And the joke I made in front of the students is alcohol could do it.
Right.
But we couldn't get that past the Institute Review Board. So,
but it is literally true that alcohol could do it. I mean,
yeah, I think it could.
That's why young artists are often drinkers or drug users, right, is to knock themselves sideways off the course of rational thought.
Anything you can do to make your mind wander from the known area in that particular knowledge domain. So it could be alcohol. It could be literally, many people have given it different names, right? So we call it using humorous improvisation to get you up to this infeasible idea space where it's crazy, it's wacky.
One of our very first episodes, we talked about the idea of, well, let's get the Pope to bless an abortion clinic.
Right. I actually have a slide on that.
Right.
It's a British tabloid found that people were brainstorming using a similar technique to what we advocate. Think of wacky ideas, and whether humor drives it or alcohol or just changing your perspective.
Just crossing a line so that you sort of obliterate.
Yeah. And the original divergent wacky ideas aren't necessarily the ones you'll use. They're there to inspire it. And if you think about it, if you take that crazy, wacky idea, well, let's have the Pope bless an abortion clinic. Obviously, he would never do that because they're against abortion. But maybe it would give you the idea to have the Pope visit or interact with an organization he otherwise might not normally do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, Pope, Catholic, maybe a Guinness brewery or something like that, because the Catholics have nothing against a good beer. And that would give you some new ideas, because the original idea was wacky. Somebody reported the wacky idea to a newspaper, and they got very upset.
As if it was for real.
At the home minister and his office for thinking of that.
So let me tell you what I saw today in the class. You and Lou got up there, and Lou ran some improv games, kind of like what you'd see on Whose Line Is It Anyway, or at the UCB, or...
Upright Citizens Brigade,
yeah,
I'm a big fan of them.
I am too. I've never been, but I love everything that comes out of it.
I took a workshop from them on improv. They're very good.
Nice. Which city?
It was here in Atlanta as part of the Black Box Comedy Festival, And one of the guys who I've seen on a commercial before, a very talented guy, gave me a lot of good insight into improv.
What was his name?
I forget. I forget a lot of things these days.
Most of those folks make their living with commercials, I think.
Yeah.
So, humor games. First one was a slideshow.
Right.
Where you have some performers who pose and then one performer who interprets that into a vacation slide.
And we start that with the engineers because they're very reticent to get up there and talk and act. So we start that
pose.
One. They don't have to talk and that gets them going. And by the end, when we did that translator one where we had two students translating in gibberish, they were quite good.
You're jumping ahead. Hold on.
I am jumping ahead.
So the first game was slideshow. Second game was
the interpreter one.
Was it only two games?
No, we did a lot of warm-ups before that.
That's why I'm thinking there's one more. So the first game was slideshow. The second game was translator, where you had one student play the chief trash collector from Monaco,
speaking Monacese.
Who was an expert in nail biting. And
don't
the
they speak
was,
French in Monaco?
I think so, yeah. So Lou took that and ran with it.
That was a little poetic license.
The other student was playing the translator, and Lou played the talk show host, who was a real sort of get up and walk around the crowd kind of thing.
Yeah.
Now, they did those improv games, and they were funny and enjoyable, and there were some neat little bits. But while that was going on, you were over to the side. Mm-hmm. With a whiteboard, and you had made these two columns.
Right.
Weird, divergent, and focused, convergent.
Convergent. Right.
Is that convergent?
Convergent, yeah.
Because
it's converging
later.
On the solutions.
So you had your whiteboard up there, and as you listened to the improv game, you had in your mind a topic. For the first game called Slideshow, it was texting and driving, which is just a... state a problem. Texting and driving is a problem.
Right.
Not that people are texting, not that people shouldn't text, not that people want to text better, but just texting and driving is a conceptual problem.
And that was an exercise. To be honest, it's better when it's more focused.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah, and we got multiple solutions. We got one solution.
You're jumping ahead again. Focus.
Sorry.
You're the kind of guy who reads the last chapter first, aren't you?
I do. I read magazines backwards. Am I the only one that does that?
I'm sure more people do that. Yeah. So slideshow was texting and driving. So Lou ran the game, and you sat to the side and listened to it.
Right. I actually watched it, too. I got some visual cues as well.
But you were also focused on writing down these things that were coming to mind. So as they did their bit, and the bit was Lou went on vacation, and his places he went were the Gates of Atlantis, the House of the Rising Sun,
and
brothel
an alley
jokes,
in
Florence.
Florence.
Italy.
Firenze, Italia.
And so he would just run with it, and they would pop up, and you know they'd look like they were about to punch each other, and he would say, oh, yeah, this was the alleyway, because it turned out that I had my Berlitz set to the wrong translation, so everything I said was, I want to kill your brother, and...
Right.
Funny stuff like that. And then you were writing down what caught your ear.
Yeah, crazy stuff that came out of the improv.
And then at the same time, were you trying to think of something with texting and driving? Were you trying?
Yeah, so I write the first one down, and I write down whatever. And then I think, okay, does that make me think of anything with texting and driving? And sometimes it's blank. So a lot of things on the right-hand column were blank. And if I thought of something, anything even remotely related, I would just sort of write it in there.
And so you were allowing this stuff to make you
to
think.
To wash over me in a creative something or other. I should have a word for that. And now the creative something or
it
other.
It washed over you like something that washes over things. So then, at the end of that performance, there was a column of wash and brothers
and a column
and
of what the wash inspired with regard to the engineering challenge.
And then you did it again with the translator, and that one, the topic was cheaper 3D printing, and they did the translator game where, you know, the talk show host says, can you ask him, you know, what's the weirdest thing you ever found in the garbage? And the first quote-unquote translator says gibberish.
Yeah.
Second person says gibberish back, and then the translator, quote-unquote, makes something up, improvs what that could have been. And so you were listening to that, too.
Right.
And allowing it to make you think of 3D printing.
Right. And that particular one, the answer was a box, and it made me think of what Luke later called a pixelated 3D printer. why not use little squares that you assemble together in something that's lower resolution rather than a molten resin? Or better yet, if you think about it, make the square really, really small, like the size of a powder. Thermally fused powders could work as well. That is a standard manufacturing treatment we use for making films and coatings. We put a powder on it, and then we either heat it or hit it with light and fuse it.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there.
The ideas are just flowing. They're flowing out my ears.
So should we talk about why you all do that or how you came up with it? Which should we do first?
Your choice.
Okay.
Why we all do that?
So why would you bother to do that, Pete? Why would you bother to set up an improv game that has nothing to do with the topic?
Right.
And then listen to it and try and come up with ideas while you're listening to it?
Because the improv is divergent. It diverges from the known knowledge of how you either deal with texting and driving or make 3D printers. It makes you think of something completely, and now for something completely different. Monty Python said it best.
Is this like someone watching television while they're also trying to think of something?
Yeah. What bothers me about academics is we'll say, well, the Lou Lefton Pete Ledovitz system is the only way to go. That's a load of crap. We've been doing this for years.
You would love it if someone would say that the Lou
I would,
Lefton,
but
Pete
I'm going
Ledovitz
to be honest, like my friend from Syracuse, and say this idea of using improv or comedy to cause divergence in your thinking to get you to a different place from which you can crystallize a totally different idea on your engineering challenge is not new. I'm trying to think of guys that I've interviewed on the radio. Randy Olson called it backing up. You know, you sort of run into a wall and then you back up and change your perspective. Jorge Sham, who is the cartoonist behind PhD Comics,
piled higher and deeper.
Right. He called it procrastinating.
Right.
That's, you know, when he was out at Caltech doing research, get up, leaving the office, going out, playing hacky sack, throwing a frisbee around, getting a latte, and just change your perspective to get a divergent idea of how to solve the problem. And the reason this is important is because if it's just, I'm going to design a pump, it has to deliver so much fluid at so much pressure and so much velocity, that's easy. There are design principles for that. But if I encounter a design conflict, meaning I need to make something cheaper and stronger, faster and lighter, those kind of things, there is no design approach for that. You have to think outside the box for something really interesting. So whenever you have that design conflict, then you need the creativity that divergent thought helps you do. And there's a 2007 study that pointed out that engineers are not as creative artistically as musicians or artists, and they're not even as technically creative. Even in their own domain, technical stuff, they can't think of something different because it seems silly to do improv games or watch TV or whatever it is that you do, to think of something totally wacky and, you know, just do that. So, for example, the analogy that Lou probably talked about on Tuesday that I often use is jokes and innovation work the same way. You go along one direction of knowledge
and then you jog
orthogonally. This is what Edvard de Bono called lateral thinking. So there's lots of names for it, but it's all the same sort of thing, you know. And I have to give a shout out to Nikki Glaser, whose joke I used in the American Society of Engineering Education paper. You know, it's a great joke. She comes out on stage and she says, you've heard about this website, right? This website where you put in your zip code and it tells you all about the sexual predators that live near you. It's called eHarmony.com. And everybody thinks that's funny, but you're going, oh, sexual predator awareness, boom. Internet dating.
Yeah.
I think that's hilarious. Same thing here. You're like, oh, well, you know, stock market trading is so difficult. The floors are crowded. People are the rate limiting step. They're slow. Well, how do we make the people faster? You don't. You get rid of them all and replace them by computers. That's NASDAQ. That's innovation. Urban legend is that the way we discovered to put power lines under the ground, which, by the way, I don't believe this is true, but it's a nice story, is people
this is
were worried
a factoid.
About, yeah, it's a factoid. It's. I'm sure it's not true, but that's okay. It illustrates the principle that some guy in the back of the room, he was asked about how do we deal with icing on power lines and power lines falling down. He said, well, forget the whole thing. Chop down the tree, chop down the power poles and just throw them in a big pit and bury them. Boom, underground power lines. And that's not how it happened, but a crazy thought is actually a good thing. So one of the guys came up with a shock color to remind people not to text or whatever it was. He's like, I know that's ridiculous. We can't do that. But think about it. We have that now.
Yeah.
There's a car that vibrates your butt when you're about to hit something.
Which means that people are always trying to hit things.
Yeah.
So the shock color is the...
That's good.
Is the far...
It's the far-fetched version of a physical warning
the
system.
The laugh is good, but when you then say... When you then say, that's good that it completely
I'm
killed
sorry,
my
I'm sorry, I just... It's the cough medicine talking.
So if you and Lou were marathon runners, would you have done some kind of workshop that used physical activity? If you were both kickboxers, would you have done something that's like calisthenics and innovation? Or does the humor thing... Does that have a very particular application that you all used?
So, I think you're right. So we applied it to what we like.
Yeah, because you guys
both
are professional comedians aside from your day jobs at Georgia Tech.
Yeah. So,
but if you were hobbyists of some kind in some other area.
Yeah, we might do it. In fact, it's already been done. It's been done for many, many decades on Madison Avenue for coming up with business and marketing ideas.
Drinking.
Drinking and humorous improv. So if you get this divergent idea, so you're trying to come up with an ad campaign for something, whatever it is, and you're brainstorming, and you do humorous improv. Humorous improv, you can act however you like. You know, this garbage collector or, you know, people in an alley in Florence. You might be improvising a talking animal, right? Talking animals don't exist, but an improv space, wacky space, they do. So you're a talking animal, and the reason it works for, say, marketing ideas is the talking animal really is not that much different than the single most successful marketing campaign for auto insurance today, the Geico Gecko. So you just write that down, talking animal. Oh, let's have an animal talk and be our spokesperson. What should we pick? I don't know. A lizard. That sounds crazy. And then they come up with a gecko. Is that an amphibian?
You're saying
a reptile? I'm not sure. Somebody send us an email. Let us know if a gecko is
an gecko.
Amphibian. A gecko. Sorry, I called him a geico.
Geico. Geico are, they're island dwellers, are they not? When I went to Hawaii that one time, little geckos everywhere, although they might have been skinks.
Skinks? A skink, I believe, is a reptile. I think that's a lizard.
So maybe a gecko's a lizard.
But
does
in
it
any
matter?
Case,
so you get a talking duck, you get bears that are using toilet paper in the woods.
Right, exactly. We thought, can we use this for humorous improvisation? And the idea actually came from Ray Vito, who runs this class. He sent me an article about this book by John Sweeney, Innovation at the Speed of Laughter. And he's been doing this for a while, and he does it with companies. And then I saw that he had talked to some technical companies like 3M. So I called his director of the improv group. So they're lizards. That means they're a reptile.
Geckos are reptiles, everyone.
So, and I asked her, and she said, oh, we're very great at that first divergence step, getting them to think of new stuff. But we've never been successful in getting them to take a original crazy idea, which, by the way, can be used in and of itself, as is, for marketing, because you can imagine anything in marketing. But to get it to go toward a real solution in engineering, which involves thermodynamics, the mass balance, the energy balance, the momentum balance, the limits of the behavior of materials and matter.
So here's my two things, right? So first, I thought it was really interesting that if you were to say humorous improvisation and innovation, you might think that the improv is about carbon nanotubes.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Although that would be, actually, people do science improv.
Yeah.
And there'll be a troupe doing that at the Atlanta Science Festival in 2014.
Do you think, well, okay.
That's a totally different thing.
Put a pin in that.
Yeah.
We'll come back to that. Well, actually, no. Let's not, screw it.
So, yeah, it doesn't matter what the improv's about. It can be about science and it can be about crazy
so
stuff.
So that's what I thought was interesting is that you're using an improv about vacation slides from the heart of Atlantis or the gates of Atlantis. And that was going to make you think of stuff about texting.
Yeah.
And the people who were doing the improv, it didn't matter if they were trained or not trained in any sort of topic. But then what was happening with you watching and trying to interpret or be inspired, clearly relying on your own training and knowledge was important.
Right.
What was happening is that watching the improv was making you bounce around differently in your skull.
Yes. And it was, and that's a change. So the way we put this together is we looked at the original brainstorming ideas of Alex Osborne. He invented brainstorming, and he wrote a book on it in 1963.
Would you say that he conceived of brainstorming?
Yeah.
Because clearly brainstorming had been happening
before.
Oh,
yeah, right. He articulated it.
Much like
right.
gravity, he did right. not discover it.
He was the first guy to...
He just said, here's a word for the yeah. thing that we do.
No, and he described it. It was very, very useful.
Did he establish some rules?
He did establish some rules. One of his rules was wild and crazy ideas, right? And don't filter the ideas, right? That they should be unfiltered. He also said that you should make a big list of these wacky ideas. And it wasn't until later, it was a 1961 study done at Purdue University that pointed out sort of the big list and completely unfiltered ideas isn't always that great. That a little bit of filtering off that original
list. A big list of unfiltered
list,
ideas could go to places that had yeah. no help.
But that's okay for marketing.
That were of no help.
Yeah, for marketing, that's okay, because the big initial list of wacky ideas, they can be used as is. Have you watched a TV commercial lately? They are whack.
Whenever I go home to see my parents, yeah. there's a lot more TV on at my parents' okay. house than at my house. And I laugh all the time. And my dad usually says
nuts.
Something along the lines of, I know you don't watch TV at home because these are all old advertisements.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a bit like a trip. If you spent too much time looking at some of those advertisements.
Yeah.
There was one about a goat that beats up somebody because of Doritos. And
isn't there a goat that farts money?
Sure. Here's the thing, right?
You got to be on drugs to think of that.
You say that. There's a goat that farts money, and my first thought is probably. You yeah. know, I don't.
It's for the lottery. It's for the Georgia lottery. But that's good for humor. Wacky stuff is good for humor. It gets your attention. It's a good advertisement. But it's not good as a solution for communications between nuclear
aircraft
carriers.
So you're trying to kind of refunnel this energy back into... Yeah. It's almost like you're detonating the explosives. And then trying to use the light and heat and noise from that detonation to
right.
do something.
Right. So we took Osborne's rules. We sort of tossed out those original two ones about being totally unfocused. Then we added a couple of rules from the folks at the IDEO Corporation out in the Bay Area in San Francisco, who there were two rules that I really liked among their approaches. And they're very successful at this sort of design innovation, some of it very technical. One was focus on the goal. So that's what gave us the idea for the convergent part. So take the initial wacky idea and see if you can take that idea and find something more focused on your engineering solution. The other one, and they believe this very strongly, is the physicality. They want you to be visual and
fizzle,
physical.
Whizzle?
Vizzle, whizzle, sizzle. Got the... What is the rap word for that? Jizzle? Whizzle? Well, that's what it's making me think of.
We are... Clearly not the people to try and remember what the rap word
yeah,
is for something.
Two bald white guys who, if you put glasses on us, would be dead ringers for Dick Cheney.
Did you notice that was the saddest, worst thing you've ever said to me? And did you notice that...
two bald white guys?
No,
is not the worst.
The resemblance to Dick Cheney. Oh. Did you notice that one of the students wrote as their for their improv prompt that one of their pet peeves was rich, white, conservative folks?
Yes, and I refrain from commenting on that because that's hilarious.
It is. It's.
Well, you're not allowed to dislike, poor.
Yeah, the exact opposite, right? That would be
yeah.
poor black liberal folks.
Yeah.
Although I think many people do dislike that group.
I think a lot
principle.
Of them are rich white conservative folks, and I can identify much better with a poor black liberal folk because I'm getting poorer as the days goes by. I tend to be liberal, and
I try to be colorblind, relatively.
Yes, I do, because we're not getting any raises. But where were we on this whole improv thing? Oh, yeah, so we had the IDEO rules, and then we augmented it with a few more rules of Keith Sawyer, who wrote a book on the genius of improvisation, really. And he talks about the beauty of improvisation as something that you'll work it and you'll emerge. An idea will emerge. So we have three steps. We have the divergent, wacky, humorous idea thing, which will take you to a crazy idea. Then we have a convergent step where we use that to inspire an idea about the engineering design problem. And then finally, we all work it together as a group and allow something to bubble to the surface. That's a very viable solution. That's the emergent part. That's what Keith Sawyer would call it.
So it feels like what you're doing is... much like a writer would write a rough draft with no care for,
right.
you know.
structure,
punctuation, spelling. You just kind of just write.
Is that how writers write? They start stream of.
No, there's a lot of different
stream of consciousness.
Stream of consciousness is an actual style, okay. Right? That's a way that you might say this book is written as a stream of consciousness, okay. or presents stream of consciousness. what I'm saying is that okay. First off, what do I know, right? Second off, this isn't everybody. But third, a writer sits down with an idea in mind or no idea at all and writes.
Okay. So whatever, no writer's work? I had no idea.
Whatever comes out on the paper will lead the way to the rest of the work, right? In the sense that almost all writers have their own way of doing things, but something that is consistent through most of the people who talk about writing, successful people who talk about writing, is a regular writing time every day.
Ah, okay.
Stephen King even said that.
I should do that.
He said he wrote every day except Christmas and 4th of July. But then he would later in a book say, I only said that in interviews because it was a more interesting answer than I write every day.
Oh, okay. But he is the single most prolific writer on the planet.
You know, I would assume so.
It's got to be close.
I haven't done the numbers.
How many books has he written?
39.
Is that all? I thought it was more than that.
No, wait. I'm sorry. That's how many of his I've read. He's written like 56 or 57
Whoa.
Books. And I've read 39. We're doing a show on Stephen King on Lost in the Stacks. The one and only Research Library Rock and Roll Radio Show.
Booyah.
That'll be on Friday.
I like Stephen King. He's kind of a cool dude. He
he is a blue-collar, no-crap guy.
He writes sports articles for the local newspaper up there in Maine.
He writes weird reviews for Entertainment Weekly, too. He just writes stuff.
He donated money to build a baseball stadium
just so he
could cover the baseball team.
Remember, he had one condition
for that.
What was his
one condition?
He donated the money for, like, the Bangor or whoever's.
Yeah.
As long as the scoreboard was set so he could see it from his office.
Oh, is his office nearby?
Close enough.
Okay. Well, that's fair. I have no problem with that.
That was the one condition, everything else. But okay, so Stephen King.
They love him up there in Maine. I was just up in Maine last year.
Yeah.
He's a cool guy.
And a writer of great success, no matter what you think of his quality.
But I like his books. I think they're neat.
So writers who write every day are usually better writers than writers who don't write every day.
I didn't start writing every day.
Part of the writing every day is simply writing. I got you covered. You know what I should explain? Well, I'm just going to cut this out. Hold for edit. That's my favorite. I don't think I'll ever actually cut something after I say hold for edit. What the hell was I talking about, Pete?
Writers who write for writer's sake are the kind of writers that write writing.
Write every day. Don't think about what you're writing. Don't think about if good.
That's
don't
the first rule of improv. Don't think. Just react.
Don't think about if this is the good stuff. And then that's your writing time. But then editing time is separate.
Editing time is when you watch the gems of prose bubble to the surface.
Do you think so? No, I think editing is when you go in and you kind of find what the hell you were chasing after.
Oh.
You know, editing is, you know, I wrote for 2 hours this morning. You know, you have lunch and then you edit after. And editing is finding the gems that rose to the surface, finding the bits that worked.
So that's very similar to improv,
away the bits
actually.
That don't.
We did a word association thing that turned out to be a story about a penguin who wore a top hat who went
that's
to the prom
what
and
I
took off their
of.
Dress.
Yeah.
It got dicey after that. And
because someone did the association.
Yeah, and that's
of
how you
dress
do. That's
off.
How you seed a long form improv.
Because
long-form
he's
improv
a 19-year-old boy.
Three acts of just crazy stuff, and you need a thread. And if the thread is sort of a little weird and disjointed, that's okay. That makes it humorous.
So. I'm thinking that an analogy would be the improv, the notes, right? The divergent stuff is the rough draft.
Yeah, the stream of consciousness.
Convergent stuff is sort of editing.
Yeah.
And then the emergent, where you actually
is the final polish, the creation of the work. That is an excellent metaphor, Charlie Bennett.
Yeah. And so this is a way you can
Where did you learn such critical thinking skills? Could it be? Georgia Tech.
In the School of Literature, Communication, and Culture, which is now Literature,
Media, and Communication,
actually.
Oh, it's communication?
They dropped the culture.
Georgia Tech, we have no culture. Oh, that's a great joke. On the 20th, later in the month, I got to talk to a bunch of I got to do some funny stuff to a bunch of high school counselors who are coming to visit. And they've given me the task to dispel the nerdy image of Georgia Tech. I'm like, look, we even got rid of culture.
I like how...
we have no culture.
You're saying that the thing you have to do is do funny stuff to... You're not going to perform. You're going to do funny stuff to people.
I mean, that makes it sound like I'm going to strap on some leather garments and do some unspeakable acts. No, I am going to educate them as to the lovely projects we have here, like my Living Learning Community as part of the Think Big program on the application of humor, and some other educational projects we have, but then do it while making them laugh. Because let's face it, they want me to dispel a myth. Dispelling a myth, that is a psychological, cultural thing. You can't do that with equations and say, well, as you can see, we aren't as nerdy as you think.
When do we dispel a myth? I mean, what would happen to dispel a myth?
Well, we have a myth. There's a myth. There's a misconception associated with Georgia Tech that we are a giant festival of nerds and we don't do anything fun or cool. And I don't think that's true. Do you think that's true?
I actually have great times on Georgia Tech.
Well, that's what I'm saying, especially with the WRK staff here. A lot of people who are very smart and major in physics and science and engineering.
I think the trouble is that a lot of people just don't think that what folks at Tech think is fun is fun.
Like the Adventure Prize and this Your Invention class?
Yeah, or just...
Yeah, but starting your own company is kind of cool.
I mean, Pi Day today, people are giving out free pies if you can name the next digit in pi.
I only know about five digits. I'll be telling some pie jokes
tonight. Is it 3.14159?
That's all I remember.
1.5 is as far as I go, too. I'm a terrible nerd.
But that's good.
Meaning I'm bad at being a nerd.
So, I should probably tell the best pie joke I ever heard.
Best pie joke right now.
Because I'll be telling it tonight.
Tell it.
And I...
Tell it.
And let me acknowledge the person who said it. No, because as a professional,
I'm
going to
cut your mic.
Joke.
Tell it.
Don McMillan. Who is probably the single best nerd comedian on the planet. He's my hero. We've interviewed him on the radio before. He's been on Tonight Show. Very fabulous comedian. And this was on his album, 512 Megabytes of Comedy. Funny guy.
Why is that funny?
Well, he says, you can tell a lot about people by the way they respond to the question, what is pi? Right? I mean, you ask a mathematician and they'll say, well, that's basically the ratio between the diameter and the circumference of a circle. You ask a physicist and they'll say it's 3.14159 and rattle off several more decimal places, right? You ask a CEO, he'll say dessert. You ask an engineer and they're always about, you know, ballpark estimates, so they don't need so many decimals. So they'll say, well, it's about 3.14, you know, something like that. And then you ask the sales guy, he'll say, listen, the engineers will tell you they can deliver it for 3.14, but I can get it to you for 2.9. I just thought that was funny. He probably tells it better than I do. Thank you, Don McMillan. You are a prince among men.
What good is that humor workshop? Do you do it for people and then should they take it away with them and start doing improv themselves?
Yes, actually, we've written a small primer. We're refining that now. We need to get that out on the website. We're trying to do more of these workshops for organizations and companies. It basically shows you a way to, one, do that initial divergent thinking to get the crazy, wacky ideas, which, by the way, hundreds and hundreds of improv troops across the United States can show you how to do. And they're happy to do it. The Brave New Workshop can do that for you out of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and John Sweeney and his folks. But I think what we can do is we can show you that it can work with a couple additional stages, this convergent and emergent stage, with nerdy experts and say, look, we're not only going to give you this big list of ideas that you can save, which will not be particularly good at coming up with technical solutions, but show you how to use these additional two stages to fine-tune it to say, for example, in the past, we've used a fart joke to design a new way to coat lead oxide particles with sulfuric acid to make lead acid batteries. We've used a bear pooping in the woods joke to design a shoe deodorizer for tennis shoes and things like that. So actually come up with a real technical product or design solution. So it's kind of unique.
Here's what I love about all this. There's a presupposition of something going on in your head, really. Mm-hmm. You know, this is for folks who are
trained. We're assuming a cognitive model. That's what we're doing.
Yeah, but this can work for anybody. It's just if the subject that you're trying to get an idea about, terrible sentence, I apologize. Let me start again. Whatever it is you're thinking about.
That's better.
if you have some knowledge about it, if you have a sense of what you're approaching, mm-hmm. if you rattle around your preconceptions,
rattle to the edges yourself, of chaos, is how some people describe it.
If you knock yourself off course, if you find yourself in some kind of eccentric orbit around what you already know, ideas can pop out. So
The path back toward your domain space can take you to a different place.
What the hell did you just say?
Meaning you knock yourself out of orbit and your path back to the center of the solar system can take you to a different space, a unique solution that might actually work.
Nice. So if you're thinking, I got to build a, I'm going to go all the way back to the beginning. You've got to build a compost bin.
Okay.
You're a person who knows how to build a bin. You know the shape of that. You kind of know what you're trying to accomplish. And I'm saying you to this person who's going to build the compost bin. If they have a few beers, they'll just build a compost bin.
Right.
This is literally how I built a compost bin.
Right.
I went to Home Depot. I bought the materials. Came home. I drank beer.
Yours is nicer than mine. Mine's chicken wire and four posts. Yours is like wood.
I think yours is probably more effective, though. Mine, as I said before... looks drunk.
Then mine looks like it's on crack, man.
But I would never have had the courage, the simple courage, to build a compost bin, to build a box in my backyard without a little bit of, okay, I'm just going to screw it. I'm going to go and buy this material, and then I'm going to, well, just crack a cold one and or two or three and see what I can do.
But if you maybe improvised on it, you would have come up with a lot of wacky ideas about how to treat the compost. Compost needs to be a little bit wet. Water helps the decomposition.
That's been a problem with my bin is I've been keeping it dry.
Yeah, and the point is you have to turn it over and water it.
So now I throw a bucket of water in. With the way I rinse out my compost bucket by filling it up with water, and then I pour it in there. So that's how I'm keeping the whole thing
wet.
But
what you should do is you should go buy yourself one of those flexible French drains, and you should... put holes in it. Those French drains usually have holes, but put holes in it on the top and the side, but maybe not the bottom, so it could actually carry water underneath it that could leak out the sides. Or so. You could think about a design to deliver water. You could put a seeper hose, those seepage hoses, literally underneath your compost.
Just I could just take the top off and let it rain in there.
Well, yeah, I don't have a top on mine for just that reason,
yeah,
because I'm lazy and I don't want to have to water it with the compost bucket. So,
the thing about, as a person who... I am a person who has a little bit of engineering knowledge because I took some classes, right? Mm-hmm. But I've really not built all that much. But my wife went out of town, and I got just...
And you got manly on her.
Got kind of a crazy idea. I got a hair right across my ass, and I went up to Home Depot, and I bought stuff, and I came back, and I built a compost bin with some help from a buddy. And that was almost me being a different kind of person because I allowed myself to be disrupted. I was disruptive. I have a terrible time when my wife's out of town.
Yeah, so divergent, that really is disruptive. We like disruptive technology. It leads to new things.
Like what?
Well, a lot of people would say that the credit card readers for your smartphone, and it started with Square, but lots of people have them now. That's disruptive technology because now people are going to be selling crap on the street that you would never sell before.
Because you've essentially said, okay, your phone's a cash register.
Yeah.
But a credit register, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the Square people, they don't charge a a fixed fee. They only charge a percentage, which means it's a little more attractive to people that sell the $3 cup of coffee. Because if they charge you, 25 cents off the top, that's a little tough. It's only a percentage, so you can go to very, very low prices. That's how I sell tickets. That's how I sell T-shirts when I'm on the road doing stand-up comedy. And a lot of people do that. That's disruptive technology.
So let's try and end this on a weird high note. What's the most disruptive thing that's happened for you in the past year or so? The useful disruptive.
I guess it's the realization that, we use humor to come up with these disruptive outside-the-box ideas here. It made me – I just realized this last year that – and this is what I was talking to Wendy at this session about – that humor isn't just something that keeps you laughing and smiling at an 8 o'clock class to keep you awake, which it does. That's a good thing. It gets endorphins going when you laugh, and that's a good thing. But also, if you take the silly example – the silly example is very illustrative to people because they don't feel intimidated by it. They don't feel put off by it, like, oh, I can't read that. That's complicated. Or worse yet, if you're a student, I give you this fancy differential equation model about the kinetics of polymer formation. And you're like, oh, I did it, and here's what the model says, but I'm too afraid to make a conclusion because the guy who's grading it is an expert in that, so I'm too hesitant. We won't be bold. But if I take the same differential equation model and I have you use it to describe the swelling of gummy bears in water, which we've done recently, then you're like, well, what does this bozo know about gummy bears? He knows nothing, or certainly doesn't know any more than I do. And I can look at, you know, most people think gummy bears just swell. They don't. The equilibrium swelling of a gummy bear is it completely dissolves.
I can hardly believe I'm having this conversation.
But it does approach a pseudo steady state that kind of goes to for a while where it swells and it levels off and then it completely dissolves. So those are very important concepts in chemical engineering and other engineering, the pseudo steady state. But people are more likely to make a bold conclusion about what this means because it's a silly, funny example. And that is a disruptive, divergent kind of idea. And that same kind of divergence can help you come up with real, viable technical solutions by at first being brave enough to say, let's suggest a crazy, wacky idea and see where it takes us. And it may take us nowhere. Most of them take you nowhere. And I guess the other thing is culturally, there are people that are very afraid of this approach because they believe engineers should have slide rules on their belts and wear bow ties and walk around saying, no, we should do it systematically. And once you get the idea, the systematic design is very important. Yeah, so there it is. Those are the two most disruptive things that I've realized over the past year.
Now ask me.
Oh, so what was the question again? What's the most disruptive thing you've observed or encountered in the last year?
Either the birth of my child.
Yes, I knew you were going to say that.
Or allowing myself to be locked in this room with you. Consilience with Pete and Charlie is a podcast about the intersection of science and the humanities.
Recorded at the WREK studios on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta, Georgia.
Do the station or the campus support our views?
I'm guessing no. Would you?